Paper 12, Section 3, which is old, single column, page 131. All right, so it's not hyper intense, but you want to make sure that you've come prepared to think. Got a little bit of physics, you know, really kind of more natural philosophy in many ways, but you know, a little bit of physics too. On the content tonight, as you might expect by the title of the first section there, universal gravity. So we'll take it fairly slow. We'll just chug our way through. And we'll make sure we appreciate what's immediately there, how they've constructed it for the, relatively new reader of the Revelation and definitely, thinking in an individuality viewpoint. But we'll take a little time to bring out the total deity picture too, which you'll see, allows you to bring in, in many ways, a little bit more immediacy of understanding to some of the things that they put forward. So let's go.
Number 3, universal gravity. All forms of force energy, material, mindal, or spiritual, are alike subject to those grasps, those universal presences, which we call gravity. Personality also is responsive to gravity, to the Father's exclusive circuit. But though this circuit is exclusive to the Father, he is not excluded from the other circuits. The universal Father is infinite and acts over all four absolute gravity circuits in the Master Universe. 1. The personality gravity of the universal Father. 2. The spirit gravity of the eternal Son. 3. The mind gravity of the conjoint actor. 4. The cosmic gravity of the Isle of Paradise.
Okay, so let's start with that. Okay, now, so first of all, notice just the way they begin. Those universal presences. So we've mentioned this, some already. That's just a reminder. So when we're talking about absolute gravity of any flavor, all four flavors here, you want to think of, in very transcendent terms. Don't think of linear material gravity and then generalize that. Go beyond all of that. Think about using the word gravity in a higher sense. And that higher sense, if you just think about the idea of the moon going around the earth, and understanding that from a linear gravity viewpoint, the basic idea of what you're, of the phenomenon that you're contemplating there is that you have a central object with another object going around that center. Okay. Now, yes, you then come up with the Newton's law of gravity and you go into the analytic details and whatnot. Okay. But the analytic details aside, let you drop back to the more philosophical picture that's in play. Regardless of how, the basic phenomenon is that there is a center and something has taken notice of that, and has conformed itself to that center. The moon just doesn't do whatever the heck it wants. It's taken up a conformal relationship to a center point. It goes about that center. You know, the center seems to be commanding it in some way to do so. Okay. So this when we're talking about these absolute presences, what we're talking about is four different flavors of a centering influence. You know, like, let's say you're talking about spirit gravity. To know that any spiritual fact in the universe is going to be caught up in this influence. It's going to find itself inexorably centered and being commanded, quote unquote, you know, to conform. You're not going to just be any sort of a random measure of spirit energy. You are going to be centered. No matter how high a spirit fact you are, this is an absolute centering influence. You will conform to that. And if you don't, then you don't exist. So, I mean, that's the backdrop of the idea of universal gravity, is that the universe will conform. And obviously, if you have no ability to overrule this influence, you're going to conform. But we all know that the Father gives us absolute free will in a certain area. You know, we can overrule that. We can say, I don't want to conform. I absolutely reject your conforming influence. No one is going to tell me what to do. The universe is going to orbit about me. I'm not going to orbit about it. Yes, you can do that. You can make that choice, but that means that you will cease to exist. Okay. Everything else, you know, that doesn't have such a gift to annihilate themselves, annihilate itself, conforms. It goes into quote-unquote orbit. You know, don't think of it necessarily literally, but, you know, your spiritual consciousness will be centered. Your mind will be centered. You know, your matter will be centered. Your personality ultimately will be centered. You will be part of a cosmic system, you know, or you won't be. All right, so... No, so this presence, so, you know, again, think about it. It's an absolutely transcendent presence as opposed to that every single point is a centering point. No matter where the spirit substance is, for instance, it will feel a centering influence. That's what these are about. Now, we know that they also, besides using the word gravity in this upstepped way, to speak of this influence, we know they also bring in the word circuit. You know, they'll say like personality circuit and things like that. Okay. We're not going to get, you know, too deep into that probably tonight. But remember in the back of your mind that if they use that terminology, you know, that they're saying, think of it in circuit terms. I mean, a circuit has to have a conductor. So any of these influences has to have some sort of a presence that is conducting it into place, and then once it is in place, it's imposing this gravity presence, this centering influence in that place. But that, you know, that's even sort of more behind the scenes of saying something like spirit gravity. Something got it out there. And then once out there, it imposes this universal centering influence on all spirit facts, or all mind facts, if it's mind gravity. Okay, now that centering influence that now is spread universally, if I start at any of those points of centering influence, I should be able to follow that back to the source. Every one of these gravity circuits has a source point, an anchor point. You know, a source point in the sense of there's this absolute point influence that is getting distributed universally. So behind every one of these, there should be, I should be able to give a definitive proper designation for that anchor point of that gravity circuit. And so when you look at this list, I mean, you notice that it's very much as gentle an on-ramp sort of use of the words as possible. Just universal Father, eternal Son, conjoint actor, Isle of Paradise. Nothing too fancy in terms of terminology. So basic seven absolutes of infinity. I mean, you do notice one that they didn't say infinite spirit. See, you notice that they used the conjoint actor designation, personal designation for the third source and center, because the conjoint actor, not the infinite spirit, can be also understood as the absolute mind, capital A, capital M. That's that absolute anchor point of mind gravity, the absolute mind, i.e., the conjoint actor. In the case of spirit gravity, the eternal Son. See, if we do the same thing here, so we could say the mind gravity of the absolute mind. You know, let's just take these bullet points and take them one more notch in specificity. The spirit gravity, instead of saying the eternal Son, you know, let's be more specific. You know, what aspect of the eternal Son? Well, the aspect that allows you to call him the absolute spirit, capital A, capital S. That absolute anchor point, that absolute centering influence relative to all spirit substance. And that gets distributed out as a universal presence. And so every point, you know, is like it. As above, so below. Every point inherits this centering influence of that absolute spirit fact. Now, let's do four first. Okay, so the cosmic gravity, or, you know, sometimes they'll say the physical gravity or the material gravity. Yeah, you know, they said cosmic here because they just wanted to take the opportunity to remind you of this universal presence fact, and the word cosmos sort of immediately invokes that. They're talking about material gravity. So the absolute anchor point is the Isle of Paradise as the absolute of matter. Okay? That's the absolute anchor point for material gravity. Now, personality gravity. Okay, we've talked about this. You know, if you want to start to think about the personality circuit, you know, quote unquote, you know, personality gravity a little bit more precisely, the first source and center is not the personality absolute. That's the second source and center. The absolute anchor point of this circuit, in order to figure that out, what is actually being encircuited? Not literally, you know, personality isn't flowing through this circuit. Personality is this individuation that's bestowed. Volition is what's flowing through that circuit. It's a volitional circuit, the exercise of will. Now, that will, that potential that's in that personality fact that was bestowed. The first source and center is the volitional absolute. You know, so the personality gravity of the volitional absolute, would be the way you would reword that in more precise terms. Okay, so the volitional absolute, the absolute spirit, the absolute mind, and the absolute of matter. Now, that at the end of that opening little paragraph there, they threw in the universal Father is infinite and acts over all four absolute gravity circuits in the master universe, like they often do, especially if they're wanting you to have a way to immediately relate to what they're talking about with the seven absolutes of infinity. And you know, see, they said the universal Father. They're always reminding you that, you know, that you may have a paradise source and center, you may have a third source and center, et cetera, but you have a first source and center behind all of that. behind those other three sources and center, there's a first source and center. And in the sense of this having an absolute anchor point, you know that you can think of that the absoluteness of the seven absolutes infinity, for the first source and center, he's the absolute of absolutes. Okay, so you could say just that generally, that that's the way you would interpret or unpack, you know, on a first level, that statement about being, you know, behind all four of them as the absolute of absolutes. But let's think about it a little more precisely than just, you know, in that sort of immediate, Zeus over the other Greek gods, sort of, absolute of absolute sort of picture of things. So we've brought this up a number of times. We have a number of alternative names that we can use, even in the individuality viewpoint, for the first source and center. Those alternative names come from the facets of deity that go into the Father in the unity viewpoint. Yeah, but we use them as alternative names in the individuality viewpoint. And we're basically in an individuality viewpoint here if we're talking about an anchor point, an absolute point. Okay, so how could I sort of directly express what they're saying there, that behind each one is the Father? Okay, well, let's start with number four and work our way up. Okay, so you have this the absolute of matter for material gravity. The first source and center behind that, immediately behind that, and engaging that fact, and in a sense, functioning through that fact, as a behind-the-scenes phenomenon, instead of calling it the universal father, that behind-the-scenes fact, we would call that the universal controller. The universal controller is that face of the first source and center that is directly, that's that impersonal face that's directly engaging the aisle, and hence material gravity. So that would be, the universal controller is behind number four. Number three, this one I don't know if we've ever really brought this up before. This taking it in many ways to the next notch. We often talk about what's behind the eternal sun, what's behind the aisle, but what about what's behind the third source and center? Maybe I'll just remind you that if you look on the infinite eternal ellipse chart here, and you look at the circuit of the Father, there's the universal controller name that we're now using as an alternative individuality name. We have other names like universal creator, and then there's universal Father, etc. Look at that. Where is that universal creator one? It's in the same wedge here as the Spirit. There's a relationship there. That's very immediate. Okay, and so if you want to be very precise in saying what face of the Father is behind the mind gravity, that's the face. The universal creator engages the third source and center behind the scenes. And that whole bit about the third source and center being the God of action, that real spear point that manifests the action. See, you can understand a little bit why that is. Because the universal creator is manifesting through that conduit. Okay? The universal creator only functions in and of itself to get that into place. And then after that, once you have the third source and center, the universal creator is behind the scenes. And really, if you want to think of it that way, functioning through that fact, not directly anymore. Okay? So behind the absolute mind, behind the conjoint actor, is the universal creator. The absolute spirit. Now there, see, with the eternal son, the absolute spirit, that's where, if you want to be really precise, behind the absolute spirit is the universal father, that personal face of the Father. So, see, if I want to be really precise, I mean, not only do I say the personality gravity of the volitional absolute, then I need to really kind of understand, well, what exactly is behind the volitional absolute? It's really not technically the universal father. That's what's behind the eternal son. And you notice a pattern here. Universal controller, universal creator, universal father. Every one of these behind-the-scenes alternative names for this first source and center that we're using here is a universal one. Okay. So it's like, well, is there another name related to the facets of deity of the Father that has the word universal in it? I mean, there's the infinite upholder. Okay, that doesn't have the word universal in it. Yeah. And not the first source, or even if you want to call it the infinite one. Okay. But that first center part, that's one of the faces of what? The universal one of infinity. Okay, that volitional absolute fact. Okay, I mean, literally the first source and center is the volitional absolute. So if you look at it in the total deity, the first source and center is the volitional absolute. Okay, not all this other stuff around the circuit of the Father. The first source and center is the volitional absolute. Okay, and that outward manifesting face of the first source and center, that's here in the absolute level, so that it can express as the volitional absolute. Remember, this is a reservoir of all will, after all. Here, the first source. What's behind that volitional absolute face? What's behind that reservoir of all will face of the first source? Behind it is the first center. Behind it is the universal one of infinity. See, so behind all four of these is a universal fact. And when you think of it that way, it's like, oh, that's an interesting way. So up front on the four of them, I have an absolute fact, the volitional absolute, the absolute spirit, the absolute mind, and the absolute matter. And behind each of those, I have a universal fact. Universal one of infinity, the universal father, the universal creator, and the universal controller. So the two together might take that absolute centering influence point that's there at the center of all things and universalize it. Spread it out into a universal gravity presence. Okay? See, so if you actually speak of it in very precise terms, it's sort of just right there. You have a universal gravity presence because if you just precisely describe what each of these is, that's just what you have. You have an absolute centering influence driven out into universal presence by one of the universalizing influences of the first source and center of all things and beings.
I'm going to bring it down. The only one I'm kind of confused about is the spirit gravity of the eternal sun, to bring it down to.
Right, and that's because we really aren't a spirit fact. So it's not surprising that we would really be kind of confused about, we've never really experienced a spirit-centering fact because we really aren't a spirit fact to experience it. We're basically a mind fact that's reaching up, trying to, be influenced by what's above us in the literalness of spirit. It's why the eternal sun is often initially puzzling to a lot of readers. Like, well, now what exactly is the eternal sun? You see, it's the same thing. everything you said, fine. All we're doing is we're trying to step back and take a more philosophical perspective on what we have an initial sense of experientially. And we're getting this big picture anchoring of, basically a validation that our experiences are not delusional, they're real, which means there has to be this whole literal structure of a source and center that's behind everything that we experience. And so we follow it back up to the source and center and we lay it out, and now we have this really top-down solid viewpoint of why it is that if I actually consecrate myself mindily, there seems to be something that comes into play that helps me be organized. You know, if I have a genuine consecration of mind, I experience a seeming self-organizing phenomenon in that higher consecrated mind. Just like I can experience a seeming self-organizing thing about matter, where, you know, even if I don't literally, you know, experience it with my body, you know, I quickly, you know, if I start studying astronomy and physics, you know, I notice that, you know, you spread out a bunch of matter and then it all wants to come together. It has this seemingly magical self-organizing, you know, thing. You know, it's because there's this centering influence, there's this conforming influence that's being imposed upon it. You know, if you genuinely consecrate your mind, you know, in mindful, spiritual, or personal fashion, you will get this automatic aid to this, so that you know, that helps you to keep from flying off on tangents with that. You know, it brings you into orbit, brings you into conformity with the system. Okay.
Yeah, and it says they're present circus, so they're always with us.
They're always with you, no matter where you are. As long as you're real, you know, you will feel them.
So when we're consecrating the mind, like you talk about, mm-hmm. consecrate to the Father first and then the mind, mm-hmm. we're consecrating to the universal creator.
Yeah, think of how, what kind of real, genuine creativity might begin to manifest through you if you took delight in cultivating a consecration of mind, so that it actually, your mind actually began to feel the absolute mind behind it, the universal creator.
Okay. And in study group at Compatto's group the other night, we learned that personality is where creativity comes from.
But at the same time, it's where the potential for conformity comes from too. And you want to have them in harmony. You don't want to be, you don't want to stake a claim for independent creativity, you know, from the universe. You want to have creativity within the system.
So
that you're upheld and your creativity, you know, can go somewhere. You know, it will be sustained and used by the Supreme Mind, rather than, you know, basically slowly shunted out of the system, you know, if you're not trying to bring yourself into harmony with the system. Yeah, Jeanette.
If the Spirit Absolute is the Eternal Son, then why do we call the conjoined actor also the Infinite Spirit?
Because that's the notch above what we're dealing with. That's Infinite Spirit. We're just working on the absolute level.
I know, but Spirit gravity is with the Eternal Son. It would seem to make sense that the Infinite Spirit would have Spirit gravity.
Again, what do you mean by absolute? I mean, fundamentally what you mean by the designation absolute is you've taken start with the I am, the infinite I am concept. You've taken that infinite concept and you've condensed that to a point that now could have a relationship to individuality. That's the absolutizing of the infinite. You know, from a individuality viewpoint, that's the top. I mean, from an individuality viewpoint, there really is no co-infinite and infinite. You know, there's no trans-absolute. As an individual fact, it all goes back to one of these absolutes. Okay, and the third source and center has one of those absolute points within its nature. But it also has stuff above that, too. you know, in a very definitive way. It's the infinite spirit, the infinite mind. All of that is trans-absolute. See, so in that sense, when you think about the conjoined actor, infinite spirit, two-side, you know, understanding, it's instead of sort of side-by-side like we often talk about it, it's a little bit more like this. The conjoined actor is facing down and engaging individuality as the absolute mind. But behind that fact, above that fact, is the infinite spirit and the infinite mind. And from an individuality viewpoint, you don't experience those directly. You basically understand what's behind the absolute mind, not as a spirit fact or a mind fact, you know, the infinite mind, but as two reservoirs, two quivers, you know, that are behind the absolute mind, okay? You know, remember they have the adjective infinite, so you know from a total deity understanding that those are reservoirs from an individuality viewpoint in some way. The infinite spirit is the reservoir for third source personality. That's that reservoir that the third source and center ladles third source personality out of, individuates third source personality of him and bestows on, you know, on creatures, like creative mother spirits. And there's another reservoir back there, the infinite mind. From an individuality viewpoint, that's not some sort of a fact. It's just a reservoir. It's the reservoir of the potential for mind activity. The universal absolute in the individuality viewpoint is a reservoir for mind energy, just, you know, the literal energiness of this stuff. But the activity that courses through it is a separate fact augmented upon that, and that comes from a separate reservoir. You know, that's how complex the thing, you know, this picture is when you really start to tease apart all the details. Okay?
You know, here again, on page 110 says the eternal sun is the unqualified personality absolute.
Right.
And now we have it as the spirit gravity.
But the eternal sun is the absolute personality, the personality that's not relative to any other personality, that absolute reference point by which all other personalities what do you want to say?
You don't have to be one or the other. Spirit, I mean, the absolute personality has to be spirit.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, personality is spirit pattern. See? You know, so in order to be the absolute personality, the absolute expression of spirit pattern, you're going to have to be the absolute spirit that's patterned. It has to be pure unity, absolutely purposed. Yeah, that is the eternal sun.
I was just going to say, I've been rereading paper 9, the second paper in the Infinite Spirit, because I just find it fascinating. It says the only thing that the conjoined actor and or infinite spirit is absolute over is mind.
But you remember when we did paper 9... You know, there's other details that you can bring in, like we did there. There are trans-absolute things in the third source and center. And because of that, you know, creatures that inherit that trans-absolute nature can do things that to a measure at least, overrule, you know, or mitigate these four absolute gravities. Like we talked about, I mean, a creative mother spirit can connect two persons together, even though from just what you have here, there's these two absolute circuits that are, you know, have separated them, these volitional circuits. But a creative mother spirit, you know, and other mother expressions, I mean, have trans-absolute nature in them, and they can connect to absolute unique persons together in the cosmic system, you know, through the individuality of the whole. That's because they can, abridge a measure of that absoluteness and connect the two together, you know, or they can negate, you know, a measure of the centering influence of the aisle, anti-material gravity. Okay? Again, that's because there's co-infinite, there's trans-absolute nature embodied in them, which they got from the stuff that's above the conjoint actor. You know, they got from the infinite spirit and the infinite mind part of the third source and center. Stuff that's transcendent of the absolute level where all these gravity things are anchored.
The only reason we have personality, mind, and stability at all, and spirit, is from this.
Yeah.
We wouldn't have it otherwise.
Right. If you took those away, you know, everything would go random. You know, there would be absolute randomness, okay, without the absolute anchor points.
Confusion, chaos,
and anarchy. See, that philosophical, I mean, the ancient Greeks understood that philosophically. That's why their story about the beginning of all things, you know, begins with chaos, you know, a word that describes an imaginary universe without absolute centering influences in it. And then they recognized that somehow those absolute centering influences came into existence and they brought order to the chaos. They turned the chaos into, what's the Greek word? It's right there in line number four, item number four, cosmos, the universal harmony. The universal harmony, like you're saying, only exists because there's absolute centering influence universally imposed upon creation. You know, if there wasn't, I mean, how could there be harmony if there wasn't something that things could come into conformity with? You know, what does harmony mean? Does it mean random? No. It means somehow something, especially like if you talk about, you know, musical harmony, think about how transcendently subtle that thought is. You know, you say someone plinks on a piano and you go, wow, that sounds harmonious. And they plink a different way and go, oh, that sounds like a cacophony. Where does that, you know, what's the difference? I mean, if you look at just jiggling of waveforms, there's just jiggling. I mean, there's just, you know, jiggling is jiggling. You know, mechanically, it's, you know, what's the difference? But you experience it totally differently because you are in relationship with the centering influences. You have a reality response to harmony as opposed to chaos, to cacophony. So you can do this. You can consecrate your mind, for instance, because you have an internal reference. You know what harmony looks like. You don't have to grope around in the dark for it, you know. Do something, if it sounds like fingernails on the chalkboard, you know it's not harmony. Don't do that again. Okay, you can tell the difference. You're given an objective ability to discriminate. You're given a measure of relationship to the absolute presences. Okay, and you can come into conformity, and you will be a manifestation of harmony then if you do. You know, if you come into conformity with all four. Matter, mind, and spirit through personality, that, you know, gives you harmony. Okay. Let's see, is there anything else? Yeah, that was a lot. Just notice one little thing. I mean, they throw a bunch of little things sort of in between the lines. Just notice how it starts out, the little challenge of how the sentence starts out in the section. All forms of force energy. So they say that, and you're immediately thinking physics. Okay, it's going to be about automatons and force charges, space, and stuff. And then let's look at the parenthetical. Material, mind, or spiritual. See, they're using the words force and energy in a more generalized sense. You know, like you can do a search for the phrase spirit force in the book, and you'll get hits, okay? And you can say, huh, what are they talking about there? You know, remember, these are three different energies, and you can generalize the words that we tend to just use for the material, or the physical part, you know, one of the three. You can generalize those words to all. All three energies. So, that's what they're saying. I mean, there's a sense of to which you can understand spirit as being a more of a potential-like thing that you would call a force, you know, and then an actual, you know, then it gets actualized, and then it's an energy, just like with matter. Spirit can be understood in the same way. All right, let's read a little more here.
These four circuits are not related to the Nether Paradise Force Center. They are neither force, energy, nor power circuits. They are absolute presence circuits, and like God, are independent of time and space.
Okay, so just, I mean, comment on that last little footnote. See there. Okay, so, see, so now in some ways they're just repeating, but notice there, see, they're really challenging you to contrast with what I just pointed out at the beginning of the section. It's like, wait a minute, he said all forms of force energy, okay, and then Chris said all that stuff about generalizing those words, and then they say that, you know, I shouldn't think of these as force energy or power circuits. Okay. Like we said, I mean, there is force energy and power, a validity to using those three words for all three types of energy. And you have that, you know, the literal energy-ness circuited in various ways. Like we were talking about Nether Paradise and really thinking about physical, you know, the physical encirclement of the force charge of space and the getting the levels and the respiration and all that sort of stuff and all these ways that the literalness of that. But see, overlaid, maybe you want to say even superimposed, maybe you could say, upon all those more literal circuiting of these energies is a presence, a centering influence that's imposed upon that, in this sense, lower encirclements, you know, that lower circuitry of the literal energiness. So that's what they mean by that. And then she's, now just notice that. It's like, wow, that's kind of subtle. I'm not sure I understand what Chris just said. Yeah, you need to sit and kind of spend some time just reflecting on it. That's what they're challenging you to do, to try to get a much bigger philosophical framework in your head. We're missing a natural philosophy in the modern age. We've, you know, long forgotten the ancient Greeks. And, you know, and they're taking it up a notch. They're trying to get us to recognize that natural philosophy is not just about matter. It's also about mind energy and spirit energy, too. So a full natural philosophy is about the threefold actuality, not just one of the folds, not just the matter fold. Okay? So, and, you know, we actually found a way to really directly understand why it's like God, independent of time and space, because behind each one of these four, there's a universal dot, 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 right? That's like God. It is God. You know, we took the name for God the Father and stuck it behind there, you know, all four of them. That's why it's like God, because God is behind it, all four. Okay. So you get this. Universally, you know, uniformly imposed presence. There's no differential. It's not like there's more presence, you know, closer to Avona than out here, you know, and there's more presence here than out in the fourth outer space level. No, this is, you know, a presence. Okay.
I'm just thinking. Well, gosh, isn't this all we need? Why do we need all this stuff from the Trinity?
Because without the Trinity, by and large, you have no way for there to be this, you know, there's no way to actualize the spreading it out within. All these things are without, remember. Like I was saying, I mean, the one thing we're not going to really talk about too much here is kind of the rest of the story about how the mother fits in, how, you know, how that God as immanence coming from the Trinity, you know, let's just do one little simple example of it. We've talked about this before. I mean, you think about spirit gravity as being this universal presence, you know, presence in or on what? You know, you can't impose a presence upon nothing. That's magic thinking. You know, or if you want to think about it in another way, you could say a presence where, Well, in here. Well, in a, yeah, but it still has, there has to be a literalness to here. This can't be just a vacuum of nothingness. I mean, like current science magically thinks. There has to be something that fills, and it's a presence in or on that. You know, whatever is the most appropriate way to think about it. Yeah. So that universal spirit gravity presence, you know, it has a presence because it's not just the existential eternal sun out transcendent of time and space. The second source of center is also the within. What is it? What do we call it? The eternal mother sun. You know, the second source and center has a God within nature.
Ubiquitous.
That's why there can be a spirit gravity presence. See, so think about it. See, that's the whole picture. You have the universal Father. You know, so the potential for universalizing is there behind the absolute spirit that's going to get, but there still has to be something that actually it gets universalized on. The eternal mother son presence is what it's universalized on. If the second source and center wasn't the eternal mother son, there couldn't be spirit gravity because there would be nothing for it to be on and in. You know, there has to be this present. You know, there has to be some way of getting it within, because the aisle and all these things are without. They're outside. They're transcendent.
They italicize presence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Present. I mean, and just, you know, the mother is the presence. And you have different things modulated on that presence.
She's the space we exist in.
Right. She is why there's a within. I mean, you can't have a nothing. Everything is a something. If there's a within, that within is a something. It's not the absence of the Father. It's another something. That's Greek natural philosophy. I mean, they're the plenum, that's called. That which has to be filling this. It can't be a nothing. That's illogical. There has to be presences.
Both the Greeks and the Hindus
think. All you need to do is just, you know, develop, you know, a more sophisticated. You know, that's what the revelation is here to do, to get you to tease all these things apart and so you can think about it very precisely. Don't get things balled together. And okay, let's read some more. Okay, so now it kind of gets a little bit more physics-y. That was the natural philosophy.
In this connection, it is interesting to record certain observations made on Uversa during recent millenniums by the Corps of Gravity researchers. This expert group of workers has arrived at the following conclusions regarding the different gravity systems of the Master Universe. 1. Physical gravity. Having formulated an estimate of the summation of the entire physical gravity capacity of the Grand Universe, they have laboriously effected a comparison of this finding with the estimated total of absolute gravity presence now operative. These calculations indicate that the total gravity action on the Grand Universe is a very small part of the estimated gravity pull of paradise, computed on the basis of the gravity response of basic physical units of universe matter. These investigators reached the amazing conclusion that the central universe and the surrounding seven super-universes are at the present time making use of only about 5% of the active functioning of the paradise absolute gravity grasp. In other words, at the present moment, about 95% of the active cosmic gravity action of the Isle of Paradise, computed on this totality theory, is engaged in controlling material systems beyond the borders of the present organized universes. These calculations all refer to absolute gravity. Linear gravity is an interactive phenomenon which can be computed only by knowing the actual paradise gravity.
Okay. kind of a lot to wrap your mind around. All right, let's tease it apart a little slowly. Let's just start with that very last little thing, so we can fit. You know, we right up front, we know what we're not talking about. It's kind of like what I said right up front. We're thinking in bigger terms. We're setting aside the more finite, linear sorts of things. Like in this instance, we're not talking about linear gravity here. We're not talking about them somehow totaling up the amount of linear gravity or anything like that. We're forgetting about linear gravity, the whole bit of, you know, how we understand the moon going around the Earth, or, you know, or anything like that. The Earth going around the sun, or, you know, or the residual of the Andromeda Nebula going about the center of mass of Nebadon, or anything like that, any of that linear gravity stuff, okay? But let's just, you know, get you to notice what the one little thing that they say, that they're pointing to in passing there at the very end. Linear gravity is an interactive phenomenon, you know, like between the moon and the Earth, which can be computed only by knowing the actual paradise gravity. What you mean? What's this little kind of a physics aside that they're mentioning there? We've mentioned this before. Okay, the basic way, you know, really that we still understand and compute linear gravity is with Newton's law of gravity, Newton's universal law of gravity. It's a very simple little notion that there's some basically kind of mystical sort of force, you know, between two masses, pulls them together, this action at a distance notion. And, you know, it diminishes as 1 over r squared, this drawing, you know, action. But see, in the numerator, what do you have? In order to calculate this thing, you've got the product of two masses divided by the square of the distance between them. That'll tell you this, how much linear gravity there is there. See, in order to calculate that ratio, I've got to know the masses. These non-linear scalar quantities. They're not vectors. They're just these numbers, these scalar numbers. Okay? You have to know how much centering influence there is in play, how much that has taken manifestation at the electronic level in a phenomenon we call mass, centered about that centering influence. You've got to know that absolute gravity part before you can calculate the ratio. I mean, you got to know what the m's are.
Gravity is a polar paradox.
Right, but see, it's a centering influence. It's what gives rise to particles being spheres and eventually having an energy in that spherical system that is, we call mass. You have to know that centered fact before you can calculate the relationship between two centered facts. You have to know the absolute gravity before you can calculate the linear. You have to know the m's before you can calculate. You can multiply the two m's together and divide it by the square of the distance. That's all they're saying. Okay? Just recognizing what that equation is saying philosophically. You can throw philosophy out and it's just equation. It's just you plug the number in. Don't think about it. Yeah, you can approach it purely mathematically, but philosophically, what is that equation saying? It's saying that you've got to know the absolute gravity before you can calculate the linear gravity. You have to know m before you can calculate the gravitational force between two masses. Okay, but we're going to set all that aside. Set that, you know, that basic, you know, real direct physics aside. What are they, you know, I mean, we're going to do this for all three. You know, next we do spiritual gravity, then we do mind gravity. You may remember this section. It's kind of a fun section in the book. What's the basic spirit of what they're doing? Let's not even try to really think in any sort of really direct way about what we mean by paradise gravity, like we did back when we were talking about nether paradise. Let's just think about what the conversation was that led up to this. We weren't talking about you know, alternate circuits or expansion and contraction, or we weren't talking about anything like that in the, you know, the, well, so far in this section. We were just talking about how there are these absolute centering influences that were present. That's what we're talking about. So with that basic notion in mind, what are they saying? They're saying, because they really understand how, you know, how this is all put together. You know, they can study this very in very great detail with, you know, great objectivity and understanding. What they're saying is they can estimate what's the total physical centering influence that's manifesting. They can, you know, make an assessment of what the total is. In other words, they can measure how much the aisle is putting out, how much centering influence is it putting out. And you don't have to go everywhere to figure that out, because remember, it's a uniform presence. You know, you can tell what the output is at any point. Okay? It's the same at every point. You can get you can figure out, like they're saying that they did, how much centering influence is being manifested by the aisle. And then they're going to take a totality theory, and you'll see they repeat that in the next two blocks too. What do they mean by that? They're saying, well, it only seems logical to us, they're saying, that if the aisle is putting out this much centering influence, it's because there's that much stuff that needs to be centered. That it's not wasting center. It's not just, you know, it's not trying to center nothing. Oh, when I say it that way, it does really sound illogical, doesn't it? No, of course, it's centering something. You know, if there's this much centering influence afoot, you know, at large in the universes, there must be that much need for centering of a physical nature. Okay? Well, so they can do the other half of this. They can go all around the grand universe and tally it up. It's like, well, how much centering influence is needed? See, and remember, see, they understand all these details of, you know, what's beyond mass and all this sort of stuff. Okay, they can tally it up. How much centering influence do you need to get everything that's in the grand universe centered? How much do you need? They make a very detailed assessment. Take a census. And they get a number. Okay, so they go, okay, so we see an amount T, you know, the of total centering influence being manifested, and the grand universe, you know, needs an amount of centering influence X. So based upon the totality theory, you know, you take T minus X and see what you get. Do you get zero? You know, are they equal? You know, in this case, no. You know, if T is 100, X is 5. Yeah, 95. You know, percent of the centering influence this is being manifested by the aisle is not needed for to center the grand universe, including the dark gravity bodies. Okay, that's the only reason why it's 5. Not so tiny, tiny little. Right. Remember the dark gravity bodies, okay? Okay, require a lot of centering influence, okay, to be. Okay, so you go back. Okay, just in the previous section, they alluded to this where they said the physicists of Uversa calculate that the energy and matter of these outer and uncharted regions already equal many times the total material mass and energy charge embraced in all seven super universes. Yeah, remember when we read that? Okay, well, we know what they're referring to. The factor is 19, you know, 95 divided by 5. Okay, it's a factor of 19 differential that's in play here. And back in the first section, they said, owing to the enormous encircling masses of the dark gravity bodies around the fringe of the central universe, the mass content of this central creation is far in excess of the total known mass of all seven sectors of the grand universe. Like I said, who knows? I mean, it's probably really, really far in excess. Okay. Because like we talked about, I mean, they're providing an influence that goes all the way out to the outer reaches of the fourth outer space level. So, you know, they're significant objects. So that's why the ratio is only 19, and not vastly more than that.
A lot of that stuff isn't.
Well, plus, the third and fourth outer space levels, you know, there's not a heck of a lot of centering influence that's needed out there yet, you know. But, right.
But still.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, so that's the spirit of this. See, they're just, you know, they can do very careful assessments, you know, and measurements and tallies of all this stuff that is really beyond our understanding. But they can tally it all up just like, you know, we would just go about it very methodically as scientists and go do all the grunt work. I mean, you know, think they're alluding to the amount of grunt work. I mean, these guys are literally, you know, practically counting the number of automatons, okay, in the grand universe and trying to get a tally of this, you know.
Star student.
Yeah.
It says laboriously.
Yeah.
It's gravity guys.
Yeah.
Well, it just says star.
Yeah.
Star student.
Well, go up to paper 30 and read about star students.
Experience. Yeah.
You could be doing it, you know, when you get up there. If you want to be a celestial astronomer, you could be a star student.
That's where they use the term experts.
Yeah.
All right. I can just imagine listening to these dry.
All right. And they kind of spread the details of this process over the next two blocks. I mean, it's basically, you know, you just have three different energies, so you're kind of doing the same thing for each of them. And so just notice, you know, if you combine what they say in all three, you kind of get the spirit of exactly what they're doing.
Are physicists in general, I mean, when they first read this, are they astounded by this once they get past the whole...
Okay. How many...
No physicists have read.
Yeah, exactly. Oh,
right.
She knows what I'm going to say.
That's right.
No, I mean, see, the first, I mean, even if you are like me, you know, someone who, you know, actually has a PhD in physics, okay, when you first read this, you go, okay, exactly, are they talking about here? I mean, it takes you years to begin to reform your worldview enough where you even have a place to hang this paragraph. You know, it just seems like I have no idea what they're talking about here exactly. Okay. You've got to develop a philosophy which you don't get in getting a doctor of philosophy anymore. You have to develop a natural philosophy, a perspective that allows you to unpack a paragraph like this, like I just did, kind of basic terms for you. I mean, the whole notion of a centering influence, you know, as being the fact that's transcendent of all the details of, you know, GMM over R squared, of Newton's law of gravity, and, you know, and all these sorts of things, and, you know, charting the Voyager spacecraft through the solar system, you know, beyond all those details of gravity that we know a lot about to many decimal places, are some fundamental understandings philosophically of what the heck gravity even is, which, you know, which science has nothing to offer you. It's not because they aren't smart people, it's because there's none of those smart people are trying to have a philosophy anymore. They have equations. They can give you the answer, but they can't tell you why. Okay, so how about spiritual gravity? How do they describe that one?
Well, by the same technique of comparative estimation and calculation, these researchers have explored the present reaction capacity of spirit gravity, and with the cooperation of solitary messengers and other spirit personalities, have arrived at the summation of the active spirit gravity of the second source and center. And it is most instructive to note that they find about the same value for the actual and functional presence of spirit gravity in the grand universe that they postulate for the present total of active spirit gravity. In other words, at the present time, practically the entire spirit gravity of the eternal sun, computed on this theory of totality, is observable as functioning in the grand universe. If these findings are dependable, we may conclude that the universes now evolving in outer space are at the present time wholly non-spiritual.
Oh, boy.
And if this is true, it would satisfactorily explain why spirit-endowed beings are in possession of little or no information about these vast energy manifestations, aside from knowing the fact of their physical existence.
Which even we know. All right. Okay, so you see, I mean, this one sounds an awful lot like the previous one because, you know, in terms of these three energies, you know, we know that two of them can really be understood as substances. You can use that word substance and have and not be distorting, you know, your understanding of what you're talking about. I mean, spirit is a substance, just like matter is a substance. Okay, so they're doing it very similarly to what they did with the matter. They're assessing how much spirit centering influence is being manifested by the second source and center, by the absolute spirit. And then they're tallying up, okay, how much spirit substance is there in the grand universe that needs centering? You know, how much does it take to center this blob of spirit substance? Okay, so you add that to your list. How much does it take to center this blob? You add that, you know, it creates this long adding tape, you know, total of how much centering influence it requires for all the spirit substances in the grand universe. And they get basically the same answers. And see, notice the fun little things. You know, a lot of times when you talk about gravity, like especially in basic Newtonian gravity, especially in like an introductory physics course, you have the notion of you've got this gravitational influence or this gravitational field, and you contemplate sort of putting it to the test a little bit, sensing it out, figuring out, you know, how much oomph it's got and where. And so you have the conceptual notion of a test particle. You know, imagine a little tiny mass that's so small that, you know, you can ignore its gravity relative to the gravity field that you're trying to assess. A test particle. Okay, when you're talking about spirit, you know, solitary messengers and other spirit personalities are the test particles. They're the little negligible chunks of spirit substance that you can use as a detector to sense what's in play.
What the spirit pull is, the total.
Yeah, from yeah, the sun. Yeah. What kind of a centering influence is in play? Okay, and you'll see when they go into the next one that this. You know, this is not a simplistic thing. It's not like you can just, there's one universal test particle. You know, they have to do some averaging and kind of, so they have, you know, you'll see this much more directly when they get to mind, that this actually is kind of difficult for them to so reduce this to this simple sort of subtraction of two numbers like this, T minus X, like we're talking about. But you know that's what they're wanting to do. They're wanting to ignore all the details, so they find ways of kind of averaging over all the details and boiling it down to just two numbers that they can subtract. Yeah. Okay, so see how they describe the mind gravity.
Mind gravity. By these same principles of comparative computation, these experts have attacked the problem of mind gravity presence and response. The mind unit of estimation was arrived at by averaging three material and three spiritual types of mentality, although the type of mind found in the power directors and their associates proved to be a disturbing factor in the effort to arrive at a basic unit for mind gravity estimation. There was little to impede the estimation of the present capacity of the third source and center for mind-gravity function in accordance with this theory of totality. Although the findings in this instance are not so conclusive as in the estimates of physical and spirit gravity, they are, comparatively considered, very instructive, even intriguing. These investigators deduce that about 85% of the mind gravity response to the intellectual drawing of the conjoint actor takes origin in the existing grand universe. This would suggest the possibility that mind activities are involved in connection with the observable physical activities now in progress throughout the realms of outer space. While this estimate is probably far from accurate, it accords in principle with our belief that intelligent force organizers are at present directing universe evolution in the space levels beyond the present outer limits of the grand universe. Whatever the nature of this postulated intelligence, it is apparently not spirit gravity responsive.
Okay, so let's kind of take the two halves of that.
Force organizers aren't spirit gravity responsive.
Okay, but let's take the first part first. Let's take the actual mind gravity thing first. Okay, so you see what, you know, what they're having to do. You know, in order to get a number, okay, you know, like 55, okay, you know, well, 55 watts. There has to be some unit, you know. Anytime we measure something, we have a unit. Yeah. You know, is it 55 meters? Is it 55 gallons? Is it, you know, I mean, there has to be some unit. So they have to try to find some way, you know, all the incredible diversity of mind, you know, that we can't even imagine because, you know, it goes way beyond the simple notion of mind that we have so far. All the complexity of mind, they have to try to find some way to unitize, you know, the mindedness of everything so that they can say, well, that's 5 there, and that's 6 there, and that's 28 there, and there's 12 there, and 1 there, and, you know, et cetera. It's, you know, and they, like they're saying, I mean, it got really fuzzy to try to count how many units of mind activity are in these power beings. Well, I mean, because they're very, I mean, they're very non-simplistic in nature, you know, and even beyond that, just think of a simple thing that you can, deduce if you put the pieces together. When they talk about the master physical controllers, you know, some of those power beings, the particular master physical controllers that are called mechanical controllers. You know, they're the ones that are actually ministering mechanical mind, for instance. So, you know, you have this domain of mechanical mind that exists in their presence. And they're having to try to somehow tally that, you know, unitize that and count it in some way. You know, it's like, well, how much mindedness is there in every blade of grass on the planet Earth? How many units of mind are there? Okay, see, this is what they're trying to do. They're trying to, you know, there's a lot more than the planet Earth. They've got to try to tally the whole grand universe like that. How many units of mind are in play so that, you know, how much centering influence will it take for that many units of mind? And then how many units of mind are manifesting? I mean, how much centering influence is manifesting? Excuse me. How much centering influence is manifesting? And then subtract it to. You know, just, I mean, this is, I remember when I first started reading the book, when I got to this, you know, this just like just totally blew the doors off my worldview. I mean, to actually talk about spirit and mind like this, in these precise physics ways,
you know,
units, you know, trying to figure out the proper units, and, you know, and okay, you know, and test particles, and I mean, that's when it really started to sink in. Oh, they're trying to tell me that everything is literal. This all isn't just our imagination and, you know, our delusions and stuff. They're trying to tell me that mind is literally an energy that physicists, you know, do experiments with and assess and measure and weigh and, okay,
quantify.
And so is spirit. I mean, in many ways, spirit is more like what you understand when you're playing with this stuff. it's just, it's, you know, you can have spirit bricks and, you know, and make spirit buildings. And, you know, when that finally started to sink in, it's like, wow, that is so radically different than what any human has ever thought. I mean, spirit substance is so far removed from some fuzzy mysticism notion that it's not even funny. There's guys that are, you know, are doing this. This is what really brought it home for me.
I had this cool scale.
Right. I mean, they're literally, yeah. They're putting the universe in the scales and weighing it. They're weighing the spirit substance of the universe. I mean, it's that literal. It's just, you know, I was getting a sense, you know how much I would have read, you know, reading from the beginning of the book. You kind of start to notice it right up in the foreword when they talk about body and mind and spirit and things like that, you know. But it just didn't really sink home until here.
Right.
No, this is like literally substance. You know, this isn't like quality. This is quantity. You know, and so this in combination with, like I said, that right at the beginning of the Eternal Isle paper, you know, in the preface there, you know, when it says all beings are domiciled on material abodes. When I put those two together, the literalness of how they're talking about spirit substance and mind energy here, that's when it really, you know, kind of sunk in. Wow, heaven is what we see through the telescope. It's not some mystical, invisible plane that's parallel to the room I'm in or something. Now, I mean, that's heaven. So calling that the heavens is, wow, that's what it is. Okay? You know, and so when you call it Urantia, you know, literally, etymologically, you know, your heavenly place, Uran is a Latin word for heaven. It's like, oh, I get it. You know, they're telling me that, you know, you literally have this physical universe, but it has literal mind and literal spirit part of it too, which I can't see with my eyes, but it's just as literal. It's a whole cosmic system of these three energies. And I live at a place, a node in that cosmic system of threefold energy, permeated with a unifying influence called personality. Yeah. And so this was kind of a real seminal point for me, and really finally making decent use out of all that work I did, you know, to get a PhD in physics. Because using it to just get, you know, calculate answers to, you know, mindless problems. All that work finally paid off. All that work in trying to get my mind to be able to comprehend things very literally and directly, not be all mystical and fuzzy about everything, but to have to really face facts. You know, and that's what really started to click at home. It's like, wow, now they've shown me how to face all of the facts. The material, the mind, the spiritual, you know, and the personal facts. To face all the facts and adjust them to my ideals. They've shown me how I can actually achieve wisdom. How I can begin to become wise. You know, and ever since, there's been this process, you know. And, you know, the reason I'm going on about it, I mean, I want you to, you know, remember. You don't have to be a PhD in physics, okay? But, like I said up front, everyone has to face facts. Everyone. Not just PhDs in physics, not just people that want to, you know, do analytic, you know, calculations. Everyone has to face facts. Everyone has to conform. There are four absolute anchor points, and they will not be mocked. Okay, they will not be denied. You need to allow yourself to be centered by them in a full fourfold way, or at some point, inexorably, you will cease to exist. Nothing can go on that isn't centered. That's why it goes on. Yeah, everything is an ongoing concern. You know how they use that phrase? Because it has an absolute anchor point as its nucleus, like matter has the aisle as its, okay. Everything has to have that absolute anchor point at its nucleus, be it matter, mind, or spirit, or it can't be an ongoing concern. It can't be centered. It just will diffuse back into the background.
Because, like, if somebody's not accepting that, then they're not in uniform. So, like, the mind would be out of whack. So that's one of the reasons why they could be annihilated, because they're not real.
Yeah. And then you start to put the pieces together. Oh, now I'm really starting to appreciate what an incredible gift of grace encirclement in the Holy Spirit is. If you're not encircled in the Holy Spirit, you have no access to the mindal anchor point, which means you are doomed to insanity. There's no way to be sane without a relationship to the absolute mind. Okay? You know, we take sanity for granted. You know, we think, well, you know, no, we're just naturally insane. No, you're not. Okay? Snip the connection to the absolute mind and see what happens to your sanity.
You won't see anything, but
there's a padded room, there's a straitjacket. That's what happens. You know, if you cut that connection to that absolute centering influence, you go insane. We're only sane by grace, because we're given that initial encirclement in the Holy Spirit by grace alone. That's why we're sane. And the extent to which you take delight in cultivating, pushing that centering influence away and wanting to be, declaring yourself to be the centering influence, absolutizing yourself, it's the extent to which you begin to unravel. Your mind will diffuse. It has no longer has a centering influence. As it unravels, you go insane.
When somebody goes insane, they can't make a rational choice.
Right. I mean, if it's irreparable insanity, no. I mean, if it truly is, cosmic insanity. I mean, if you literally have unraveled like that, you know, where you're not encircled in the Holy Spirit anymore. I mean, you've experienced spiritual death. Your adjuster's left, and you know, and it's just a blob of inertia that's ongoing. Yep. Okay. Now, the thing that John was noticing, the other part of this of that statement, I mean, they're talking about those force organizers. See, this is a clue. They don't say a lot about the force organizers. They're very mysterious beings. You know, you have the primary transcendental master force organizers and the associate, or I mean, the primary eventuated, primary eventuated master force organizers and the associate transcendental master force organizers. They're such mouthfuls, I can hardly even say them. You know, you have to keep all those words separate in your mind to even say their names. It's very mysterious about exactly, you know, where they come from, what they are. You know, but this is a clue. That's why they say, this is intriguing. So this is basically giving us direct evidence. We found a way to measure them. they're minded, which, of course, I mean, they have to be minded. But they apparently are not really blobs of spirit energy in any way. Okay? There's some kind of apparently physical mindal being or something. See, yeah. So that's why they're saying there's a lot of intrigue. I guess you'd say to this measurement.
Are they the same as the Paradise Force organized?
Yeah. Right. The force organized, the ones that start, the primary ones that start the whirls, and the secondary ones that condense the world into automatons? Yeah, well, now, those beings.
Now, it seems to me, once we get to finaliter stage and we're going out to those outer universe levels, that's the major way we're going to be growing, because we've already achieved spirit ascension. We've already achieved the maximum of spirit, it seems like. So when we go out to the ultimate, when we explore the frontiers of the ultimate, we're going to be doing more or less, we're going to be mainly expanding the mind.
Be careful, you're making a little bit of a false extrapolation. You've topped out in terms of spirit relative to supremacy, but not ultimacy. Okay. You got forever to go relative to ultimacy. Okay. But
it seems like if you think of mind as a differential between mm-hmm. matter and spirit, mm-hmm. we're talking about a differential here where we can't see the spirit, but know it has to be there. Mm-hmm. We must be talking about something that's super absolute, not...
Well,
we're talking here about absolute.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things we know we're talking about, like, especially the primaries. They're really transcendent. Remember we talked about them back when we were talking about Nether Paradise? I mean, they do stuff way transcendent of starting up worlds. They're back there, you know, somehow near Nether Paradise or however the heck you're supposed to think about it, somehow interfacing with that center of all things phenomenon. Not only about taking unpervaded space and making it pervaded, for instance, by passing through their presence, but something, I remember I pointed out, there's something even more transcendent than that going on. Taking unpervadable space and turning it into pervadable space. In other words, really forget about the force charge. You know, we're just talking about space potency here. We're talking about the presence of the unqualified. Okay, so these are really transcendent beings of some mysterious nature, see?
It's so obvious by the way they're describing this, because they're trying to calculate it,
uh-huh.
You know that it must be coming from an infinite source.
You know, I mean, other than the fact that they, they have a lot more understanding of the details of the physical, and or the energy nature of these three energies. They aren't much more knowledgeable about some things than we are. A lot of this stuff is giant question marks in their mind too. And they tell you that several. You know, remember how many times they say, "Well, that's basically all we can say." In other words, we really don't know any more about it than you do. Okay. I have a mind that goes so far beyond you. You can't even imagine, you know, the kind of mind I have. You know, divine counselors say or something. You know. But when all is said and done about this issue, your guess is as good as mine. You know, the fact that I've got a bigger finite mind than you doesn't help me here. This is not about how big your finite mind is. This is about transfinite stuff or whatever. And I don't know. And he also say sometimes. Now, technically, if you could really get up to speed as an ascending sun and get, you know, a more intimate relationship with your fragment as a father, you might actually be able to figure out some stuff that there's no way for me to figure out. I don't have access to a potential source of information like that.
Oh, so we can write a Urantia book for them.
But I want everyone to know I'm way short of, being able to do that. Teach a divine counselor anything. Let's see here. Okay. Let's read the last little bit here.
But all these computations are at best estimates based on assumed laws. We think they are fairly reliable. Even if a few spirit beings were located in outer space, their collective presence would not markedly influence calculations involving such enormous measurements. Personality gravity is non-computable. We recognize the circuit, but we cannot measure either qualitative or quantitative realities responsive thereto.
Okay, so right. So the first thing, it doesn't matter if you think about it as qualitative or quantitative, it's just not a thing. You know, I mean, it's certainly not a substance-like thing, and it's not even a differential between two substances, energy-like thing. It's not a force. I mean, it's just not thing, you know, in any tangible sense. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's personality conceptually is a thing, okay? It's an individuation, but not an, it's not tangible. It's not a tangible thing. You know, another way to, you know, interpret what they're saying is there's no test particle to go about this, tallying this. There's no, you know, because it's just not a thing that's tangible. You know, if it was a thing that's tangible, you could come up with some kind of a test particle that you could hold and move around and test with, you know. But it's just not, you know, that kind of a thing. So that's what's behind that. But what that really is saying, like I said, I mean, it obviously is a thing. It's not a nothing. It's obviously a thing. But what kind of a thing is it? It's a thing that's so transcendent that not even the highest beings that they have access to think of it as grabbable, as tangible. It's a very transcendent thing. You know, where does it come from? It comes from the other side of the horizon line, okay? Beyond the horizon lies the reservoir of all will. You know, beyond what can be seen, beyond what can be touched. See, beyond the tangible line, beyond the horizon line. Right, there below. Okay. You know, Father and Creator and Controller.
Is it because it's potential?
Yeah. Well, I mean, when you're talking about the personality circuit, what's encircuited is the volition, the actualization of the potential that is personality, flowing as it were. You know, it's just what is the, what's the conductor for this circuit? Is it material substance? No. Is it mind energy? No. Is it spirit substance? No. I mean, what's the conductor for this circuit? Deity. Mother deity. It's, raw deity is the conductor. That's, again, a reminder of just how transcendent a fact this is.
Is there any connection to the way that they wrote these in order and how they give the definitions in their order?
Yeah, a lot of times...
Because you notice the personality paragraph was so short.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, because it was non-descriptive.
Yeah.
Right. But why did they put them in the orders that they did when they put them 1 through 4 here?
Yeah. It's not. So you noticed up front that they went personality, spirit, mind, matter. You know, they literally went like this. They went up the chart: personality, spirit, mind, matter. 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, so they put them in, basically this order, where, you have the threefold actuality together in the order of individuality, associativity, unity, and then you have the harmonizing influence. Okay, so that's one way that you can order the four. It's the way I ordered them on that chart, same way they ordered them in that first list. You'll notice a lot of times in the book when they're talking about the sources and centers, they won't put them in that order. They'll put them in this order where where it's kind of like what I've been describing. You have two substances. You've got material substance, spirit substance. So that's you got the two endpoints, and then you have the energy between them. So a lot of times they'll put it in that order rather than matter, mind, spirit. They'll go matter, spirit, mind. And then as they mentioned personality too, then that'll come after that. So here they're just stressing what I did as we were reading them. The matter and the spirit ones are kind of quite similar in their description. You've got two literal substances. They're quite tangible. Mind is not as tangible. Yeah, you know, it's not like a substance. And so it was harder for them to come up with units of it. You know, you just don't have bricks of mind, you know, that are natural units of mind. It's not a substance.
Mind's okay. Somewhat ubiquitous. Right. The indefinite the equation was, that was the order in which they...
Did you notice that? So, yeah, besides what I just said about that simple two poles and then the relationship, then you notice that they're in that order of the individuality substance is obviously the most tangible. The unity substance, it's a substance, so it's tangible, but it's not as tangible as the individuality substance. And then mind is even less tangible, and then personality is completely intangible. Yeah, see, so they're in the tangibility order. That's the kind of thing you want to be doing. I'm really glad to see how you're getting that spirit. That's what they want you to do. Everything has a purpose. Everything is ordered for a purpose. It's trying to get you to think in a certain direction so that it's easier for truth, the truth that they want you to engage, to flow through this and hence through you as you create a relationship with it. You got to notice those details. It's not just because, you love to fixate on minutia, you know, and drive people crazy. I mean, like I said, I mean, all of us need to develop a relationship with facts. All of us need to. Not a fixation on facts. We don't want to become fact finders. The facts are not ends in themselves. But you have to find the facts, it's impossible to find the truth that flows through facts. Truth doesn't just flow. It flows through facts. If you have no relationship with the facts, it's impossible to have a relationship with truth.
And the reason that the personality can't be their major is because it's from God.
Yeah, I mean, you know just how intangible the personality thing becomes. I mean, if actual personality actualization is in play, you can't calculate it in advance. When it's just the energies, if you know the initial conditions, you can basically just calculate it. You know, just crank the thing forward and, you know, after 500 years, it will look like this, you know. But if personality actually actualizes anywhere, that's not calculable in advance. Because there's genuine creativity flowing into space and time through that conduit. Like we just figured out why. You know?
And it comes from the infinite.
Right, and all that stuff, you know, it goes all the way back, okay? Yeah, we went all the way back to the first center, you know, to see what was behind that circuit. Yeah. All right. I figured it would take us probably the whole time to just do that one thing. And it's good, too. I mean, it's really too much to try to do the two of these. I mean, the next one has got a lot of stuff in it, so... You know, we really need to be kind of content to basically probably do one of these sections at a time, because there's a lot there. We'll just try to. We won't try to unpack everything because it's almost endless. But especially the closer it gets to actually alluding to direct physics stuff, you know, there's just like huge doorways that you could walk through and start, you know, going down the path. And we're not going to do that, but I'll try to at least give you a sense of the doorways that they're, you know, laying out in a lot of these paragraphs so you can get a sense of, you know, of what the potential of the revelation is for someone who wants to think about some of these things. Remember, it's the better set of initial assumptions. Everything that you need to reform all human thinking is in here. You know, and nothing is outdated. Okay? Truth does not go out of date. Okay?
There's old science in the book.
The only reason you would think it's outdated is because you're lazy.
Right.
You're too lazy
to follow the truth.
Just like they say, in the same way that current scientists are lazy, they say, well, that's just caused by magic. You know, remember what they say about that. You know, people who say that the magic is the source for things, basically they're lazy. They're too lazy to find the causes. You know, if you think it's outdated, you're too lazy to find the truth. You know, don't be too lazy to find the truth, for Pete's sake. I mean, think of, you know, just say that to yourself. It's like, what on earth am I thinking? I'm too lazy to find the truth? Well, what kind of a future do I have in the universe then if I'm too lazy to find the truth? If the truth is not in you, oh, that whole vine and the branches and the fire thing comes in. Okay, I don't even want to go there, see? I mean, you don't want to be too lazy to find the truth, okay? All right. So, let's take a moment here.